It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, it's my great pleasure to once again introduce three people who are panelists for another edition of Valley Edition. Here in the studio, we have Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mike.
And we also have in the studio, Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Good morning, Mike.
And on the phone, we have Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hello, everybody.
Well, much of this week is, at least the end of the week, is being dominated by the fair. It has begun. It began on Thursday. The weather has been moderately accommodating, generally pretty, a little gray, but there's hope for the future. It looks like we'll have a little rain and a little sun, et cetera. I have been out there. Terry, I know, has been out there. We have survived the first day. Mark, have you been there yet?
Have not been there yet.
Okay. And Zaz, have you been out to the fair yet?
Yeah, I actually went to the fair on Wednesday to write what I thought would be kind of an interesting primer on how the state handles ride inspections.
Oh.
But it turned into a hard news story yesterday when the state filed an unusual investigation, started an investigation into an incident up at the Tanana Valley Fair earlier this month.
I
cobbled two stories together yesterday into one that should be in the paper today.
I read that, and I just why don't we just touch upon that? Because it was, as I understand, very unusual, and we had a lot of inspectors, some from a national level, some from a state level. How about a summary, a quick summary?
Well, the inspectors at the fair, at the Alaska State Fair this week, are not unusual. Every year, the state requires all amusement rides in the state be inspected, but the state doesn't have a nationally certified amusement ride inspector on staff. So a third party hired by the fair operator or their insurance company handles the inspection, and the state signs off on whatever report they come up with. And so what happened at the Tanana Valley Fair is separate from that. At Tanana, the fair was underway. All the rides there had also been inspected, and the state had signed off on those inspections. And for reasons unknown, there was a mechanical failure, and the Orient Express Dragon Kitty roller coaster went out of the slot that one of the wheels was normally in. And so it stopped all of a sudden, and there were about a dozen people in the ride, and a woman and her three kids say that they got injured. They got whiplash, basically, because it stopped so fast. I think that ride can go as fast as 50 miles an hour. I don't know how fast it was going. I don't think it was going that fast, but still, you know, if you're in a vehicle that stops suddenly, the same thing happens. And so the whole thing just kind of illustrates the way the state process works on amusement park rides, which is one of those things you don't think about until you do. And it is sort of a hands-off process apart from these annual inspections that they were doing at the fair, with little incident, I should add. But when something happens during a ride, you know, something goes wrong, as it kind of often does. I think we've all been at fairs where, like, something isn't working or they have to take a 15-minute break and get everybody off the ride. That isn't reportable to the state. It's only reportable if somebody dies or gets hurt enough that they need a doctor's care. And even that was kind of up for debate in Fairbanks until the woman involved provided her medical records to the state yesterday afternoon. And even now, the owner of the ride, A1 Midway, contends that they didn't see anybody get hurt and sort of less than subtly question this woman's account. So we'll see where all that goes. But that fair and that ride is over anyway. The procedure the state takes in accident investigations is they shut down the ride until they can figure out what went wrong and make sure it won't happen again, or at least look at paperwork and the ride itself and fix it.
So different vendor here in Palmer, though, right?
Yes. The vendor here in Palmer is Golden Wheel Amusements, and they have had there have only been two reportable accidents since 07, since the state's database is kind of up, or at least active, and neither involved Golden Wheel.
So question about inspections. If they're, you said that inspections happen just on an annual basis?
The state
mandated
inspections once a year.
Mm-hmm. this thing. Do you see any changes coming out of this?
I think that statute is very broad here. I mean, the simple fact that they were, I mean, I understand that I think it's the industry, or rather the public, would understand not wanting to punish an operator if someone decides to go after them unfairly. But right now, the language is so broad in the statute, for instance, in this, when is it a reportable accident, that, you know, unless you can prove you went to a doctor and got a diagnosis, the state doesn't find out about it. And I think that this may shed a little bit of light on that process. I don't know if there will be a change or not. I think what Golden Wheel kind of spoke to in the story is that we want to get out ahead of such changes. We don't want legislation. Why would they? So we want to make sure we're as safe as possible. And I have to say, in my limited experience level, Golden Wheel does spend mm-hmm. a lot. I mean, they spend $350,000 on liability insurance mm-hmm. every year. And so their insurance company is pretty strict about who they send up to inspect and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
So bottom line, it would appear that these inspections, sparked by what happened in Fairbanks, resulted in a lot of work uncovering a few what appeared to be minor things well before people arrived at the fair and began writing.
I think it also
this inspection at the Palmer Fair, at the Alaska State Fair, would have happened regardless of Tanana. This was an annual inspection. This was not inspectors coming out because of concerns raised by what happened in Fairbanks.
Okay. Terry?
Yeah, I think this kind of sort of speaks to the way Alaska is sort of a hands-off approach to any type of regulation or inspection. I mean, even just the food industry, in my brief experience with it, it was, and I know it's been cut back a lot, and there are restaurants that go literally years without any inspection, unless there's a problem, and then everybody gets up in arms. And, you know, that's one way to look at it. And the other way is to have some good protections in there so that you don't have any incidences. But there's certainly been much bigger problems in the lower 48 with carnivals and rides, but then they're, you know, bigger events also. So,
okay. Well, moving on, we have a second topic which drew a pretty heavy crowd, actually. It was a crowd on Tuesday night over at the Borough Building. There were two meetings happening simultaneously, one at the Palmer City Council, but the other one involved fish. And we had a commissioner from the state come in, Commissioner Cotton, and there were a fairly large number of people and some heated comments made about why we don't seem to see as many silvers up this way. Zaz, once again, did you have any comment about that summary?
In general, these fish meetings sometimes can be fairly dry, especially if you're going to the Board of Fisheries. But this, and really all of the kind of the Cook Inlet allocation issues, for lack of a less wonky word, where different user groups are basically fighting over who gets the fish. It happens on the Kenai, happens in Anchorage, happens between set netters and drift netters and dip netters, anglers and guides. But the issue up here is a little more complicated because of what's called a mixed stock fishery. So you've got the commercial fleet in the inlet, not the set net fleet, but the drift gill net, the guys who are in the open-ish water, are setting nets that are indiscriminate. They catch whatever goes through them. And there are the sockeye that they're targeting, but there's also the coho, silver salmon, that they aren't necessarily targeting and are really popular for regular folks to catch and guides to come up in August to go fishing. You know, it's sort of the money fish in Mat-Su as our kings early in the season. But silvers are really kind of the people fishery. And so the concern in Mat-Su is that the state for years, one particularly angry gentleman from Willow says it's been 30 years, but the state has been managing all along for the commercial fleet at the expense of Mat-Su and at the expense of salmon conservation. And so this was basically the Mat-Su Fish and Wildlife Commission's chance, along with the public, to take their message to the Commissioner of Fish and Game, Sam Cotton, who does have commercial fishing ties in his background. And so they lit into him, basically. I'm not sure what will result. I think the overarching point made by both Fish and Wildlife Commission members and the state-level officials and some people in the audience were including a Board of Fisheries member, was you all need to show up at the next Board of Fisheries meeting where these issues come up and take all this emotion and all this information and leave it there, because those are the people making these policy decisions that are behind the management plans, that are behind your concerns.
And when they don't have one of those for, they don't have them every year, do they? Or
no, it's a long cycle. I don't know when the next fisheries board meeting is coming up on that two issues. They just had one in March. Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to look at a picture of that meeting and notice people sitting, and also there were descriptions of who was there. And some people who did not speak, certainly there was a lot of testimony, but I think a large representation from the Valley delegation was there. My understanding, they didn't have very much to say. I know that afterwards, one of the advantages of going to the fair is that there are a lot of people there, and there are people gathered sometimes who have political positions, et cetera. And so there was still discussion about this that I heard, meeting people at the fair, but I didn't. When I've asked, okay, what's the next step? What do you do? This is a frustrating experience some people are having, but what's the action? And I think you're accurate in saying, really, it's at that board level. And it's a reminder that the people that are on there are appointed by the governor. And so discussions with the governor about who's going to be sitting there, who's going to be the commissioner, it's probably... if there's dissatisfaction, this is probably the way to go. Any comment, Mark?
No, it sounds well covered. I'm curious, though. It sounds, for the most part, like, you know, theme and variation of stuff we've heard over and over. Zaz, do you see anything new and different here, or perhaps a change coming from it?
A change, I don't know. And yes, Mark, it does. I mean, I. These days, I don't write about every meeting I cover, and this one I went in, you know, just to see what was going to happen, and came out, well, there were 75 people there, mm-hmm. and they were angry, and so did write a story. You know, a lot of the contentions are the same. I think, I don't know the biology in any way at an expert level, but, you know, it does seem as if some of the people who know those rivers pretty well are saying, like, you guys may be fishing these stocks. If not into extinction, then at least into an area of concern, which is crazy given the numbers that used to come back. And so I think what's changed is there's a little bit more of an air of urgency. And there were two commercial openings, and one July 31 and one early August, August 4th or 6th, 4th, I think, that really frustrated people because... this was as the returns past the Weir and the Little Sioux of silvers were still super low, like under 200 fish. Mm. And the state opened up, because of a Board of Fisheries decision, opened up commercial fishing. Mm. And they kind of hammered the silvers. I mean, they caught more silvers than sockeye in those two openings. And so that really kind of ticked people off at a new level, I think.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know. In fact, I asked somebody at the same reception. Mike was out last night. And I guess they're working on some data exactly how that feeds Alaskan families. I mean, there are a lot of families I know in Mansu and just all over Alaska that kind of supplement, their grocery bill by going out. And not only is it an enjoyable thing for the family to do, but they actually depend upon that. And they're just, I guess they don't really have any hard numbers about that. But apparently they're looking at that now because, you know, that is part of the, you know, eating locally and... it'd be interesting, not just, you know, not just the natives, that's a whole different conversation, but also, you know, people that, you know, actual families that just do it for recreational, but it has a benefit of cutting down their grocery bill, and it'd be good to know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the data is so, I mean, that raises a good point, Terry, that those numbers are hard to come mm-hmm. by accurately because there are so many multipliers in effect, but mm-hmm. that is a problem, you know, knowing exactly who's benefiting from this fish apart from, you know, the export dollars. But also how many fish there are, and that did come up quite a bit, is that especially in Mansu, I mean, the science on the Kenai isn't 100%, and, mm-hmm. and they have sonar. They've spent a lot of money on equipment down there, but the equipment up here, that was, I think, three of the four requests of the state from the Fish and Wildlife Commission on the borough level was, we need better equipment to get data so we know even remotely how many fish are expected to come back and are actually coming back.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered that meeting, which was well attended. I was also over at the Palmer City Council meeting, and I think it's worth mentioning that there were 10 people there. 12. Well, we have to count the council. Well, there really weren't people in the audience there, in part because it was a short agenda. And I'll mention two things. One, that the city manager was evaluated in an executive session at the end of the meeting. And my understanding, he is continuing on as city manager with a bonus, and I don't know exactly what that means. The other topic that came up actually came up in the report that the manager gave earlier in the meeting. And it was interesting because it was a reference to his testimony, if you will, at an earlier borough assembly meeting regarding plastic bags, and basically sharing some information that he had obtained about what had been happening with plastic bags. But he was very, very careful to convey that the city council had not taken a position on this. And the reason why I bring it up is because there was a meeting last night, Thursday night, over in Wasilla, because Wasilla is moving forward on this, meaning that the mayor in Wasilla has invited testimony, commentary about what Wasilla should do. And what was interesting is that both at the borough assembly meeting earlier and the city Palmer's meeting, they're both looking to Wasilla. It would appear at this point that Wasilla is in the driver's seat. It's driving this conversation, et cetera. There was one person, one member of the Palmer City Council, that was Pete LaFrance, who said, I think we need to take a position and that we want to do it earlier in the game, probably well before, say, December, when the Borough Assembly will be taking this back up, so that we have something to throw in rather than being reactive. That was my impression. I think the council was quiet in responding to that, in part because it's possible that it'll be the same city council, or as we all know, there are two seats up and there may be two new members sitting there, and that might have a significant impact upon what Palmer decides to do. For listeners, it's just a reminder that right now it appears, I say appears because there's a little bit of talk about this, that the cities in the borough can ban, but the borough cannot. I think that's pretty accurate, but there's still been questions raised about why the borough, can the borough do or not? And even though the attorney at the borough level has spoken, there's still some questions that have been raised about that. So in any case, it does not appear that anything borough-wide will happen with plastic bags until Wasilla acts, Palmer acts, and then the borough takes a look at this.
Mark. So does there appear to be the will on either city council to ban?
Well, my impression, and I'll ask Terry to throw in here, my impression is the mayor in Wasilla doesn't bring things up unless there's some direction of change that would happen. Terry, what's your thought?
Well, I think that's why he's convening the town hall, to get some feedback and to get some interaction from the community. So I think we'll have a better idea after that happens. But, Palmer has a different way of doing things than Wasilla. Wasilla, I think it's fair to say, is more proactive than reactive, and that they take a faster approach on things than Palmer does sometimes. So Palmer sometimes likes to sit back and see what the other players do. And they do have, in all fairness, they do have time. It's December 5th is when the borough is going to get together. And, the mayors still have their weekly, I think, little get-together where they just talk and have lunch. So this could be all bubbling up, behind the scenes, I think.
Okay.
So hopefully it is.
Yeah, it's certainly a topic that has had attracted a solution or two. The one that was proposed at the borough assembly, I think, could be called not quite ready, not finished. There's more discussion, having input from the cities and so on. It seems to be a good idea. What size stores, for example, would you, if you were going to do an excise tax, what it would be everybody, it would be a certain size. All of those things are still in flux, I would say.
Yeah, and this is one of those issues where you get sort of odd bedfellows together, because it could be argued that even when we just talked about fisheries, so there is a lot of impact on streams and fish from plastic bags. And You know, one approach is to get together and all, you know, ask that it be a statewide thing, that the state, that it come from the state as a band or some other legislation, and they all, you know, get behind that. So there's a lot of different forks in the road, and as someone says, sometimes you just have to sit down and have lunch and think about which way to go.
Okay. Well, since you brought up the state, Terry, just mentioned that yesterday there's always an event at 4 o'clock on the first Thursday of the fair, where many, many people gather together, and in part focuses on honoring the Farm Family of the Year. It's also an opportunity for many people who are, in this case, because next year there will be elections coming on, so there are typically a number of people who will be potentially involved in an election there to talk. And also it gives you a chance walking around the fair. I had this opportunity to note that there are some booths that are up and some positions that are being taken relative to actions of the present governor or the rest of it. So one of the things that I always encourage is if you're at the fair, certainly there's all of the food and the fun activities, and the farm animals, but there's also an opportunity to engage with people. In my experience, where I can remember, yes, you can have a conversation with a candidate who may well become the next governor. Or another representative or senator from this area, because they're there. And even though there's a large crowd of people and they do interact, it's a wonderful opportunity. And I know next Wednesday, for example, there's a joint chamber meeting
Wassel and Palmer.
Right.
And Senator Murkowski is the keynote.
Right. And so I know that Senator Murkowski will be there and Senator Sullivan will be at the fair at some point. And my experience, again, over the years is you can interact. They're not so busy there. That's what they're there for. And although there may be some very specific speaking engagements, et cetera, there are very other times. I know we interview directly and do that, but there's a lot of people that can have contact. And this is a rare kind of opportunity, so I'd recommend it. Now, the other thing, Zaz, since we haven't talked to you, heard your voice for a little bit, is the story associated with the ADN. I know that there was an action taken by a judge that has allowed a bankruptcy proceeding to go along and a loan to be accepted. Any comment whatsoever about that whole process now at the Alaska Dispatch News?
Oh, I think I know, or you know, as much as I know, glad to see that we got a reprieve, and the bankruptcy hearing is September 11th. So meanwhile, we're all just doing the jobs we've been doing all along.
Right. Well, I wanted to state immediately that, yes, in fact, we've just talked about a number of stories. I keep thinking, okay, take the paper away. What's going to fill the gap in terms of providing that kind of reportage, that kind of experience that goes in and actually talks to a variety of people and writes it coherently? I mean, it's something that I think people, and I've heard this before, you see letters to the editor, you see people speak about it, even though there might be complaints about a particular paper's position on things or an editorial opinion piece, et cetera, I still believe that that print edition is a very, very helpful way to convey what's happening. Mark, any comments?
I would just add to that, on top of the print edition, the website, getting the information out, regardless of how it's gotten out, is critical to the social and cultural
well-being
of Alaskans.
Right. And one of the things that I know at a national level is continually being addressed is the role of the media in relationship to the national government and the president. That's been out there. There have been a number of people who have decried coverage of one sort or another. But one of the things that I still come away with that is most important is the ability of someone who is familiar with a topic area, who has experience, history, can fact check immediately, catching, well, that sounds wrong because I was there and that didn't happen, and go back to sources, source information, and provide a fact checking, because it appears that we have most recently seen very loose handling. In fact, outright misremembering or misspeaking or just wrong statements about something that seems a foundation element to any story, whether it's the classic numbers of people who were in a meeting or whatever. So I just would add my congratulations to the continuance of the paper and your good work, Zaz. Well,
thanks, Mike.
Yeah. Okay. Now, just before we finish here, an opportunity for any other comments. Particularly, I'm going to address the fair because I'm going to guess that everyone here on the panel will go at least one more time. So beginning with Terry, what's the most focused, important thing you want to do at the fair before it finishes
this year? Well, three quick comments here. I'm headed there now from here, actually, and there are going to be a celebration in the Borealis tent for the smoke-free fair. We have the only smoke-free fair in the nation. Today, this year, all smoking will be outside the gates, and that's something to celebrate. Puts us on the map for that. Good job. American Lung Association is going to be there from 1 to 3 celebrating, so that's where I'll be today. And then Tuesday, AARP is going to have the day at the fair, so I'll be there all day on that day. And since I'm lucky enough to live in Palmer, just about every other day, because it's quite an accomplishment out there, and I encourage everybody to go out there. Amazing free entertainment out there along with some good concerts. But I do want to make a shout-out to some friends who may have relatives and friends in Texas. It does look like Hurricane Harvey's going to hit them with a wallop. So, you know, keep an eye out. Go out, fun at the fair, but be thinking about your friends and family in Texas as they get poured upon.
Okay. Thank you, Terry. Mark?
Well covered, Terry, and congrats on her part as well for this smoke-free fair milestone. On top of all that good stuff, the free entertainment and whatnot, there's also all that fine, healthy, and nutritious fair food that I'm looking forward to.
Well, Bush's is there, and they've got fresh vegetables, so there's that.
And the potatoes.
Yeah, wonderful.
Okay, that leaves you, Zaz. What's your goal for the fair this year?
My goal, I guess, is to find a cream hand and a zucchini in the other. and also seek out any goats and pigs I can.
Oh.
A lot, very much alive.
Right. And okay, just I will mention that I have a grandson who's showing a pig at the fair. He's done that for a number of years now. And when you go over there, if you're lucky enough, if you go early enough, it's likely that a hairy pig will be there. And you definitely want to see the Hungarian hairy pig.
Oh, definitely.
So that's it. My goal is to survive the full 12 days where we broadcast live from the fair from noon to 5 every day and have great interactions with all the people who wander by. So we've reached that point once again where I say we've come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. I want to thank Zaz Hollander for calling in. Thank you, Zaz.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Always good to be here.
Great. And I want to thank Terry Snyder for coming in to the studio. Thank
Glad
you, Terry.
Glad to be here, and good job, Zaz. Good reporting.
And I want to thank Mark Kelsey. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. We'll be back again next week for another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.